This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Supreme Court was in session at the county courthouse in Middlebury yesterday, hearing oral arguments on several cases. Among them was one that raises questions of how and where commercial solar projects can be built in Vermont. In 2013, the White River Junction-based company Grow Solar proposed a commercial solar field to be placed in Rutland Town. The panels would occupy 15 acres of land and generate 2.3 megawatts of power, which Grow Solar says is roughly the amount of energy used by 400 homes. The Vermont Public Service Board reviewed the Grow Solar proposal and, after lengthy review, issued a certificate of public good, meaning the project can go forward. But Rutland Town, where the project will be built, says not so fast. Leaders there say they don't oppose solar, per se, but they do object to the impact this project would have on their town. They argue the Public Service Board didn't take the town's zoning and planning rules into sufficient consideration. Yesterday, lawyers for both sides made their case to the Vermont Supreme Court in a case that hinges on energy priorities and local control. Today, we've asked people on both sides of that case to join us and explain what's at stake. Later this hour, we'll hear from a select board member in Rutland Town. But first, Rod Viennes joins us from our studio in Norwich. He's executive vice president of Grow Solar, the developer that wants to build this solar facility. Rod Viennes, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
Why do you need to site the project in this particular location in Rutland Town? It's on 15 acres of fallow farmland next to Cold River Road in Rutland Town. So why there? Why is it essential to have it there?
So let's go back to how we actually found this site. I'm sorry, in the spring of 2013, we worked with a commercial real estate agent who had been working for many years with the Rutland Economic Development Corporation to market this site commercially. This site is listed in the Rutland Town Plan future use map as industrial commercial. So, you know, our initial indication was that this would be an acceptable place for a project given the town's future use map. Not only that, the project is located within a half mile of a substation. It abuts the Quality Lane Industrial Park, and it's also located nearby to a industrial recycling transfer station less than a quarter mile down the road. So this site really spoke to us as a commercial opportunity.
And the fact that it's near a substation is crucial to the plan?
Yeah, correct. You know, we have to upgrade some three-phase lines, but that distance is about a half mile, so being closer to a substation is always better.
Nonetheless, Rutland Town says that this proposal sort of falls afoul of what they've put into their zoning and regulations, specifically about solar siting, and you have pushed forward with it. So why is it so necessary or beneficial that it's worth it to keep pushing?
So it's interesting that the town of Rutland, I believe to this day, doesn't really have any zoning bylaws. They started their solar siting policy about 4 months after we had started moving on this project. Those solar siting policies really were not they were not voted on by the select board until August of 2014, and that was 8 months after we had submitted our application for certificate of public good. So,
But the Public Service Board took 15 months to rule, right? So they could still take that into consideration.
Yeah, and exactly, Jane. And even though these solar siting policies or bylaws were under development and review, we feel that the Public Service Board gave due consideration to those policies. And honestly, at the end of the day, the project complies with, I think, all but one of the siting policies that the board ended up voting on, and that one area that we would be out of compliance with the town siting policy would be the 500-foot setback that they imposed near a historic residence, and we felt, and I think the Public Service Board agreed that that was put in there really to push this project out. Now, again, there's no zoning in Rutland. But the town of Rutland came up with these solar siting bylaws, or what we would call zoning.
Right. So they do have zoning then.
Well, you could argue that.
Still, so they say, so you've sort of mentioned that the zoning rules came into place, it seems like, in response to this specific project. Nonetheless, how do you respond to the town's concerns, not whether or not they have zoning regulations, but the concerns that this will have significant negative aesthetic impact on the surrounding properties and from a mountain lookout in the town, and that it does fall afoul of these rules that they've put in place?
Yeah, so this was all considered by the Public Service Board. It was a lengthy process. It was 15 months from the day we applied to when we received the certificate of public good. Within those 15 months, there were three public site visits. The last public site visit was attended by all the members of the Public Service Board. At all three public site visits, we walked our property, and we went to all the neighbors' land, walked up to them, walked up to the properties, looked at the views, talked with the neighbors. Then we had 4 days of technical hearings where we had our aesthetics consultants.
When you talked with all the neighbors, though, Rod, did they all say go forward with our blessing?
No, not at all. We offered to mitigate views with landscaping on our side of the project or on their land. The neighbors really just didn't want this project, or they don't want that project there. And, I think at one point the hearing officer even requested that the parties meet, and we had offered many, many times, and they just didn't want the project there, and refused it altogether. But the process, the Public Service Board process for this project was very lengthy, very complete. 4 days of technical hearings. The landowners hired aesthetics consultants. The Department of Public Service hired aesthetics consultants, and Grow Solar hired aesthetics consultants. All resulting with the same view that there was no adverse impact to property owners.
So I guess that's the answer then to the question of the town is saying, and some property owners are saying, this has negative aesthetic impacts. Your response is no, it doesn't.
Well, our response is to the average person, which is what the Quiche analysis, the test that we have to comply with, to the average person, it doesn't. Sure, there are private property owners that there is an aesthetic impact. But with that said, part of the Public Service Board process, there were concessions we had to make at the request of the Department of Public Service, ANR, and the PSB itself. Whereas, we doubled the amount of plantings on the site. We have 576 bushes, 72 trees. That planting program is about $165,000. We eliminated, at the request of the PSB, we eliminated telephone utility poles. We're going underground. We've avoided wetlands. We also agreed to keep the current hedgerow in place between the road and the neighbors. So there were concessions made to visually mitigate from the neighbors.
Today we're talking about one very specific solar siting case that's being considered by the Vermont Supreme Court. It's one way to understand how solar development is unfolding around the state and why several communities feel like they don't have a voice in how these projects are being planned and implemented, sometimes in what they feel are violations of their own local zoning ordinances. We're hearing first from the developer of this solar installation in Rutland Town. Rod Vienz is Executive Vice President of Grow Solar. And coming up, we'll hear from Rutland Town Select Board Member Don Chaffee. If you've got a perspective from your town, you can share it on our webpage. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Or if you have a question for either of our guests about this specific project, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Rod, what would happen if you weren't able to build here? How essential is it for this project to move forward?
Well, Jane, we've been through almost 2.5 years of developing this project. There's monies we spent. Of course, those monies would be lost. These projects help mitigate utility transmission costs going forward. I think, in 2014, there was a Velco study that said between energy efficiency, solar and wind, Velco was able to avoid $150 million in transmission line upgrades. That's a direct savings to customers. And this project contributes to that. And so, when GMP talks about not having a cost increase in the last 3 out of 4 years, part of that reason is that these solar projects, wind projects, are really helping to shave demand in the state and saving customers money. Now, you know, again, you got to realize that these projects are at a fixed price to the utility. So for at least 25 years, the cost of power to the utility is fixed. And, you know, some folks believe that, you know, our utility prices are under control because of the long-term play that the utilities made with Hydro-Québec. And so I think this is sort of the modern-day Hydro-Québec, whereas, you know, you're seeing 25 to 35-year power purchase agreements that are stably priced and fixed.
So that's why you think it may be essential to our overall energy plan and to consumers. For your company, you operate in 12 states. You've got a lot of different projects on the go. If you lose this one, is that a big deal?
If we lose this one, again, financially it hurts. We never want to lose a project. And, you know, with that said, we've walked away from a lot of projects. So we have felt that pain after developing, you know, going not as far as this one, going part of the way and losing a project. But, you know, we think this is a well-placed project. Again, it's on a piece of commercial industrial land. So that would really send a really bad statement to other developers operating in Vermont. Developers need some reliability, and this project getting turned down would be quite a statement, and not good for the overall industry.
How does your experience in Vermont compare to your experience in other states?
I wish I could. It sounds like I planted that question, but I didn't. But so, you know, as you said, Jane, we operate in 12 to 15 states. We develop and build projects. And Vermont, the Public Service Board process for these utility-scale projects is among the most rigorous, if not the most rigorous. You know, we bring in many, many consultants. It's a state permit, and it's, you know, it's 12 months to 15 months long. So Vermont is our toughest state to get a permit in for solar. In most other states, we're in and out of the permitting process in 2 or 3 months.
Rod, do you understand why communities in Vermont, we're hearing from many of them now, several dozens, who just feel like they're being left out of this process when the projects are being proposed by developers and approved by the state and being placed in their communities and they don't feel like they have a say? Do you understand that frustration?
Oh, we so we're Vermont based. We've been here for 17 years. We understand that. They're our neighbors. I think the towns now, given the 2015 legislation, have automatic party status in all these petitions. So I think the legislature also heard the complaints of some of the towns. I think developers, certainly Grow Solar and other developers, are doing a good job and a better job in some instances with bringing the towns in early, bringing in the neighbors early, doing those early discussions, getting folks on board, getting feedback before we get to a situation where a town opposes the project. And again, there's automatic party status as of May 2015 for most towns. So we understand. We're sensitive. And Jane, we've walked away from a lot of sites. A lot of sites people don't even know we walked away from. We do some early due diligence, and we're not unlike other developers. Developers are getting better. And do we have room for improvement? Sure. Are there some bad projects out there that aren't well cited? Sure. But I think the whole community is listening, and trying to work with neighbors, work with towns, and mitigate any aesthetic impact.
Let's go to the phones. Daniel is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on. I've been listening to all these siting committees or these hearings, and I think it's really shocking that we're missing the larger context for things, which is the fact that our very planet is threatened. We're worried about aesthetics. That's like worrying about someone's appearance when they have a fundamental health problem. Our whole planet's at risk. We're dealing with the death of our oceans. So it's really, I think it's the epitome of vanity to value these aesthetics over the life of everyone, not just humans, but animals. The entire ecosystem depends upon us doing something. We also could lose all our maples. I drive down Route 7. It's beautiful. There's lots of solar and lots of maple trees. I don't want our climate to change and Vermont to not be what it is now. So I just ask folks to keep in context the larger situation. Global climate change could irrevocably alter things, not only aesthetically, but we have a moral imperative to solve this. And
Daniel, yeah, I got your position. Thanks for that. Route 7 corridor, one of the places where if you drive down it, particularly in Addison County in the town of New Haven and continuing on south, where you will see a lot of solar panels. Rod Vience, how would you respond to Daniel's thoughts there?
Yeah, Daniel, I agree. You know, Vermont has a comprehensive energy plan, and it's going to benefit everybody in the state and on the planet. That plan calls for 90% renewables by 2050. And there are many ways we're going to get there, and solar just being a piece of that. Energy efficiency, wind, solar, these projects are for the public good. Again, they're local solar projects providing renewable distributed generation. And in addition to that, they're providing great jobs for many, many Vermonters, not only solar developers, but all of our subcontractors, electricians, landscapers, you know, fence companies and otherwise. So, yeah, the big picture is we have a real issue on our hands. It's going to take lots of parts and pieces, a lot of folks working together and to provide a solution.
Before we let you go, Rod, just quickly, how did you feel like the hearing went yesterday before the Vermont Supreme Court in Middlebury?
I thought the hearing went well. Justice Dooley had some good questions. I think the Public Service Board is going. I think the Supreme Court will certainly see that the Public Service Board process was very complete and rigorous for this project. So you know, we're confident we're going to hopefully have a good result.
Rod Vience is Executive Vice President of Grow Solar. Thank you very much for explaining your position.
Thank you for having us.
Grow Solar is a commercial solar developer based in White River Junction, and Grow Solar has proposed a 15-acre, 2.3-megawatt solar field in Rutland Town. The town of Rutland opposes the plan, and the case to determine whether or not this project goes forward has reached the Vermont Supreme Court. A hearing was held yesterday, and we're getting a sense from our guests today of how they think the hearing went and what's at stake for their side. Coming up, we're going to hear from the other side in this case. Rutland Town Select Board member Don Chaffee joins us just ahead, and we welcome your comments and questions for him. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been learning about a dispute in Rutland Town over the siting of a solar project that would cover 15 acres in the town and produce 2.3 megawatts of power. The developer is Grow Solar, and the subsidiary that would run it is Rutland Renewable Energy. Rutland Town's Select Board opposes the plan. It says the proposal violates the town's zoning rules, and the state's Public Service Board shouldn't be able to supersede the town's wishes on solar siting. The disagreement is the basis of a Vermont Supreme Court case, and the court heard oral arguments yesterday. Today we're talking with key players in this case. We just heard from Rod Vience, Executive Vice President of Grow Solar, and now we're going to hear from a leader in Rutland Town. If you want to share your questions or comments on this case, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on solar siting and the roles that communities should have on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Don Chaffee is the Select Board member in Rutland Town. He says he and the town don't oppose solar projects in general, but they feel the process for reviewing this one ran roughshod over local zoning and planning decisions. Don is in upstate New York. We appreciate you taking time out of your travels to join us. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be with you.
Vermont has a goal of getting 90% of its power from renewable sources by 2050, and a big part of that plan is going to be solar power. Federal and state incentives and initiatives make it appealing for Vermont homeowners and developers to integrate solar panels into our landscape. You have said you're not opposed to solar in the general sense, but you and the Select Board are opposed to this particular project. Can you get into the specifics of why this 15-acre parcel is the wrong place for this project?
Well, you know, first of all, there's a lot of inaccuracies in what Mr. Veen says. But, I want to say, first of all, that we have no personal animosities towards Mr. Veen's or his company. We're not anti-business. We're certainly not anti-solar. But right from the get-go on this particular project, as you know, Rutland City has billed itself as the solar capital of the world, and they want that nomenclature, and they want to work with Green Mountain Power to do that, and that's fine. They're an adjoining municipality, and they can do that. The energy companies, the solar energy companies, the renewables, have a really good relationship with Rutland City, and they've worked with the city leaders to identify projects that the city leaders approve before they even put them in for application. So, in other words, they've consulted on a very, very lengthy schedule with the city to determine what sites are appropriate. That process never took place with the town of Rutland, and that was the very first thing that alerted us that we had to become a lot more active in this particular issue, because we weren't asked about this. They just identified the site and went in and put the application in and basically said, we're going for it. They never asked our leaders whether we thought that it was appropriate.
So, Don, is the problem that you're not being consulted, or is it this particular parcel that's the problem?
Well, it's the whole planning process. The planning process starts with a collaborative relationship between the developer and the community, and that never took place because they never asked the Planning Commission or the Select Board whether we thought, in any private discussions or public discussions, whether we thought that was an appropriate location for the project. And they use this designation, and they've made this case even to the Supreme Court. They've made this case that because that land is, quote, designated commercial industrial, that therefore that gives them the unfettered right to do this development on there. But what's not being told to the public is that we don't have zoning. That town plan designation of commercial industrial was done over 20 years ago, and it was done at a time before solar even became apparent, and it was done at a time when we didn't use the deliberative process that we have now in place for proper planning in the town. It basically was just they contacted the landowners along different routes all over the town and asked them how they wanted their land designated, and pretty much the Planning Commission designated it that way and put it in the town plan. That doesn't mean it was appropriate then. And sure, do I apologize for the fact that 20 years ago we didn't do planning properly? Maybe. But the fact of the matter is that that's been agricultural land for the last 30 years. It's been farmed. It's prime agricultural soils. And the town went through a process, a very deliberative process, that has been long tried and tested in this state, of adoption of local planning in the siting issue. We adopted the solar siting regulations after many, many meetings, many discussions, many revisions, and we adopted it as part of our town plan. The fact that the PSB rejected that plan, which had in it prohibitions on solar on prime agricultural lands and many, many other features in there, said to us that the local planning process was not being respected.
Don, before we leave the question of the land, though, let me just ask you one more question. This is private land. It's otherwise not being farmed at the moment. It may be prime agricultural land, but it's currently not being farmed or preserved. It's a private developer, and it's a project that fits with the state's overall strategy. The Public Service Board has said that this is in the public interest, so why shouldn't it move forward?
Well, that was a question that was asked at the Supreme Court level yesterday, and I thought that the questioning was very, very precise and very intuitive questioning, both on the part of Justice Robinson and Justice Dooley had some really good questions. Justice Dooley got into that particular thing with both parties.
But what's your take?
Just what is the public interest versus what is the private interest? And we took the position that there's really not much difference between the public and the private interest. And the fact that the Public Service Board has taken the position, I might add, against the Queechy analysis, which they have always maintained would prevail in these cases, which was that if a well-thought-out identified community standard, a clear and concise community standard was identified, that should prevail in the hearings. If that took place, that should control. And that didn't take place at the Public Service Board level. So the view that they take, that the public driving by the site has more importance and more weight in the aesthetic argument than the people who actually live there, is a flawed argument. And that was what was argued at the Supreme Court level, and I firmly believe that the people living there obviously have a greater impact on them than a casual passerby.
These are the neighbors. You feel that the neighbors should have more of a say in whether or not this project is sited within their viewshed.
That's correct, and the reason is very simple, that the casual passerby, quote, the public or the general public, they don't pay taxes on that land. They don't have that land evaluated in terms of its aesthetic value and then taxed according to that by the local municipality. They just drive by in their car. They have no stake in this as far as the loss of value.
Let's go to a call, Don. We've got other listeners who have similar thoughts to you here or objections, and let's get to a couple of them. Chris is calling in from Windsor. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hello. I just want to comment on I'm echoing the same sentiments as your guest right now. In Windsor, we've been in a similar situation regarding the prison Martone Road property. Grow Solar had a presentation earlier in the year. As your guest said, we weren't asked, and until the day they arrived, the select board did not know, was not informed of their decision to go ahead with this 4.25 megawatt, which would have been the biggest project today in the state on that piece of land in Windsor. Now, this isn't about aesthetics, as your guest said. This is about the proper siting and us having a choice. We have not had a choice. They brought us in way, way late in the game. And that is not a fair due process. It's not democratic. And as the people living in the town, as well as taxpayers and the people that currently use that, once again, this is not about aesthetics. This is about proper siting. And when it comes down to Grow Solar and GMP, it's about money. They want the easiest place, for the most part, to put a huge group of panels, and that's too much sometimes for one town to absorb, or especially if it's a piece of land people have been currently using for generations, to make that sacrifice, especially if they haven't even been consulted. Now, that can be a win-win for both the solar company and the community, but not if they're just bowled over and told, this is where we're going to put it. You need to contribute to global warming, the reduction of it, as I heard your caller from Burlington say. There's currently tons of sites around the state. Infrastructure already exists. There's buildings, there's parking garages, there's all types of things, but what it comes down for them is cost. They don't want to part with that, and therefore you have to say, well, we're just going to put it on that land, and that helps everybody, so do your part.
Chris, I got it, and let me put that to Don Chaffee here, because what you're saying is in your community you felt a similar thing, and Don Chaffee, Rutland Town has actually encouraged other towns to sign on to a resolution urging the legislature to provide a mechanism for communities to have more say in energy siting proposals moving forward. What changes to the process would feel more fair to you?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Windsor and your caller's comments, because Windsor is one of the communities that signed on. There are 50 communities in the state of Vermont that have signed on to that resolution. So even though Justice Dooley appropriately pointed out at the Supreme Court level yesterday that, well, that may be a political situation and that can be remedied politically, he's correct. But there's also an impact, and the impact of 50 communities in the state as opposed to just one arguing this these particular points, I think, is quite significant. It's like a bell that you can't unring. And, you know, that those 50 communities represent a tremendous geographical area of the state of Vermont and a tremendous citizen base. So it isn't just one little whining community. And all we're asking for is that democracy be adhered to. And democracy requires that the local planning process have some meaning. If it doesn't have any meaning, then there is no point to having planning commissions. There's no point to having select boards that conduct due deliberative process, gain citizen input, and really agonize over these decisions, because it isn't easy. We're not opposed to solar. What we're opposed to is the solar companies having the sole right to dictate to our communities where it's going to be, how big it's going to be. And even the governor having weighed in on this by saying that Ranger Solar is too massive a project. Well, that's one person. He happens to be the governor, but that's one person's attitude of what massive means to him. This project, Grow Solar, is operating is a 2.2 megawatt on 15 acres out of 23-acre parcel. Directly adjacent to that parcel, there's a 50-acre piece which has been purchased to put solar on, and it's forested, and they plan to deforest the whole 50 acres and put it on there. That total adds up to 75 acres, which is pretty much close to the 100 acres that the governor is saying is too massive for this state. So the total impact of this thing is of much greater magnitude than people think. And it's just the attitude that it's up to the local community to decide in its best views how to integrate solar into its community. All we are asking for is the same courtesies that were given to Rutland City when those discussions took place in Rutland City as to where do we want to put solar, up at the landfill. That was a great project, and, you know, I compliment them for that. So what do we want for change? It's very simple. We want our planning process to be considered as having more weight than just them reading the document and then totally dismissing it.
So, Don, if the Supreme Court does not rule in your favor, what kind of precedent do you think that sets for communities?
I think it sets a very, very bad precedent, because I think that the tide is turning in this particular issue, and I think the people are beginning, as they start to see the visual impact, and even when the Supreme Court says, well, it's in the public good, or the public view is what's the people driving by, the total public in terms of aesthetics, I think you're getting a lot more people that are seeing the visual impact of project after project after project covering up good prime agricultural lands along our major arterial highways. When we said just 25 years ago that it wasn't appropriate to put billboards there, these panels are billboards for the solar companies. And there they are, in your face.
Don, how do you feel your side did yesterday in the hearings before the Supreme Court?
I think the arguments were very well presented by both Attorney George and our attorney, Kevin Brown. And I really think that based on the questioning of the justices, that they have some real, real issues to consider in terms not maybe of rejecting, but maybe remanding this back to the PSB to give that solar siting document more consideration. And not only will they be vindicating our fight to have local planning mean something, but they'll be vindicating 50 towns in the state. And I'm sure there's going to be more by the time this thing is over.
That's Don Chaffee. He's a select board member in Rutland Town. The town opposes a commercial solar project that's been proposed by developer Grow Solar to be run by a subsidiary called Rutland Renewable Energy. Don, sorry for cutting you off. Thank you very much for your perspective today.
Thank you for having me.
And in case you missed it, we spoke with a Grow Solar representative about this project to be built on 15 acres in Rutland Town earlier in the program. You can listen back to that conversation at vpr.net after the show ends. Coming up, one woman's take on ethical fur. She sources her pelts from local roadkill. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A few weeks back, we did a show on roadkill and the tension points between wildlife and human transportation. We're coming back to that subject today with a guest who has addressed the issue head-on by starting her own business. Pamela Paquin is the woman behind Petite More Furs. She makes what she calls ethical fur, muffs, wraps, scarves, and more, sourced from roadkill. Pamela Paquin joins us now. Thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure.
So what exactly is ethical fur?
That is a label that other people have given to my fur. I tend to call it accidental fur because, of course, we all have a different idea of what is and is not ethical. However, my fur comes and is sourced exclusively from highway departments, animal control officers, and wildlife officers, sometimes the police if they get the call. And myself and my sources pick it up, tag it, and then can use it to make fur that has not been caged, skinned alive, and all the other things that is rightfully so very disturbing to think about within the fur industry itself.
Why do you feel like you should be contributing to the fur industry, though, even with ethical fur? So what is it about, you know, having fur clothing and fur fashion that is appealing?
That's a great question. I am not a fashion designer. I was never in fashion. I was a sustainability consultant. I started my work at the MIT Sloan School with the Society for Organizational Learning, looking at systems dynamics, complex systems dynamics, and leadership within business. And as I lived in Europe, in Denmark, in fact, which produces a large portion of the world's mink, I would take my ferrets on my days off around to the local furriers and introduce them and say, they're very sweet, and could you please stop making products out of their cousins? That didn't seem to work. And I donated to PETA's anti-fur campaign, and of course the fur industry continued to grow. So with all of that, it was a real dilemma. And when I came back to the United States as a new mom, I was feeling very maternal and nurturing, and was horrified, again, to see all these bodies. We have so much more than the places in Europe that I lived, because we still have so much forest here in New England. And it was very disturbing, and I just was really upset that I had to drive by, that there was nothing I could do, not even to stop and recognize them. And when I had to change my career to be a new mom and be with my daughter, I couldn't travel the way I used to. And I thought, well, where is there something that needs doing that I can do and still be there to pick her up off the bus at 3 every afternoon? And my cat is attacking my arm right now. Minu, get down. This was something that was just so compelling, I just couldn't turn away. So I started talking with the wildlife officers in New Hampshire at the time. I had worked at the Donella Meadows Institute in Norwich, Vermont, as the director of education and outreach, and seen some incredible efforts done in Vermont and New Hampshire with regard to systemic change, the local economy, local banking, Hardwick terroir, and so on. Very inspiring, and much like what I had seen in Europe. So I thought, well, here's a gap, here's an opportunity, here's a very clear place of pain and conflict between us and wildlife. So I got my fur buyer's license and had some local taxidermists and hunters teach me how to skin an animal. I thought I really needed to do this firsthand in order to make sure that it was viable. And began, really, worked with a local seamstress, made some pieces, and took them into Boston and New York City, and the response was brilliant, and I started selling pieces immediately.
Who buys your pieces, Pamela?
I do accessories, because, of course, I don't have the hundreds of bodies required to make one coat. So neck muffs, hats, mittens, leg warmers, everything that's small and easy to put together, say, from one coyote or two raccoons.
But these pieces aren't cheap either.
No, no, and that's actually a good point. I was speaking to Sam about that earlier. My pieces, because typically each piece has at least 30 man hours put into it, I would consider cheap at $1,000. If you consider what the average rate of pay is, that's a livable wage in New England. And all of my work happens in New England. And as a single mother, of course, I know exactly what it means when you are offered minimum wage. You can't live on that. But yes, my pieces start usually at $1,000. And I'm very keen, as you think systemically, of course, that the local people who live around here, not just a segment of them, but that they can all afford to buy my pieces. I have many people who support what I do, but just can't afford the $1,000. And so I'm looking to make pieces under $1,000, like my pom-pom hats and woolen scarves and mittens that have fur on them, but aren't quite so expensive.
Pamela, when you sell to somebody, I assume they're coming to you partly because they feel a connection to how you're sourcing your fur and that it is this sustainable fur, or what has been dubbed and what you call on your website ethical fur. But is there a tag or a brand logo or something that's going to display that so that a wearer walking down the street, it will be apparent to viewers who walk by that this is fur that is sourced ethically? Or does it just
Absolutely.
Look like a regular fur stole?
Nope. So as somebody who had never worn fur before myself, I created a sterling silver assay marked badge with an individual number for each piece that traces back to my paperwork that you can see. It's about the size of a quarter, and it's on every single piece that I make. And in that way, it is very clear that this is a Petit Mort fur. And not only is it clear that it is one of my furs, but it actually has a number on it engraved in metal that traces back to my paperwork.
So people will be able to see that on the wearer if they're, you know, it's part of that, part of the idea of wearing your fur is wearing that badge.
Absolutely. And I have people who come to me who've never worn fur before who donate to anti-fur campaigns all around the world. I also have people who have been habitual fur wearers and just feel better about this. They get to connect with the spirit of the animal that they're wearing rather than disassociating from it because they know what it went through to become a fur garment was really awful.
What's the response been like to your business?
Overwhelming. Honestly, I'm going into my second sales season, and I was just awarded the best clothing designer for Boston by Best of Boston for 2015. I have designers from all over the world calling me asking to purchase my pelts wholesale. I have clients from all over the world. Last Christmas and holiday season, I sewed so much myself that my fingers were numb. I couldn't feel things when I picked them up for about 2 months afterward. It's quite a thing. It's very touching. Very touching and very encouraging. And now I'm just trying to find enough people and capital to respond to that demand. I'm currently looking at building, I guess, what you would call a factory, hiring full-time the local seamstresses I work with now on a contractual basis and the suppliers that I have around Massachusetts and the rest of New England to be able to scale up and meet the demand.
So if somebody is driving along and they see roadkill, is there a way for them to sort of donate to you, or do you only go through authorities?
Yeah, not directly. I've had that, and I thank people for that, but I can never take an animal from an individual. It has to go through the highway departments and animal control officers, and that's specifically because essentially their job and honesty is tied to the paperwork that I pick up.
So do you see this as part of a model for sustainability that ties in with other sustainability models, the local food movement, other kinds of fashion movements that are tied to sustainable sourcing and ethical production?
Absolutely. Very much tied. And I've worked in those industries from timber to oil to food. So I know that was where all of my ideas and aspirations came from. There's been some wonderful examples set there. I would say that people now know, especially because of the internet and global connection, that things like the fire in Bangladesh that kill, you know, thousands of people every year, that's happening. If you want to go to H&M or buy low-priced clothing at Walmart, you are directly contributing to the suffering and death of people. If you wear synthetics and polyesters, that's petroleum that is killing billions of animals around the globe. People know about this stuff. They get it, and they want an alternative. But there's a double whammy there. There's providing the alternative, and then there's also people being able to afford it. And so that goes right back into things like raising the minimum wage.
Well, and that's apparently, you know, starting from ethical fur and going all the way to the minimum wage. We'll leave it there. Powerful words there, though. Pamela Paquin makes what she calls ethical fur sourced from roadkill. Her company is called Petite More, and we have more information at vpr.net. Pamela, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And it's time now for the mailbag, when we read a selection of your comments to the show. Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen joins us now. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Jane. Glad to be here. On Monday, our guest was singer and songwriter Nico Case, who lives in a farmhouse in the Northeast Kingdom when she's not out touring and recording. State Senator Tim Ash sent us this email after the interview. I'm not a big social media guy, but I do follow Ms. Case on Twitter. It was through her tweets about her friend's difficulties accessing needed mental health services in the kingdom that I came to truly appreciate the acute nature of the problem in that region of the state. It led Senators Jane Kitchell, Claire Ayer, and me to push for more funds to reimburse mental health professionals. The increase we secured was modest but meaningful. Thanks go in part to Nico.
We also got a story in response to last week's show on a new book celebrating the history of the Vermont State House. Scott wrote, "As a former legislator, I discovered a similarity between our Vermont State House and one of the old chambers in the U.S. Capitol. Once during a roll call vote in the Vermont House chamber, I was sitting at seat 34. I heard a member who sat about three rows behind me cast her vote, and it sounded like her voice came from the opposite side of the chamber."
Scott continues, "I remember when I visited the U.S. Capitol in high school that our tour guide told us about the old Senate chamber, which had a domed or rounded ceiling. It allowed sound to travel up and come back down on the other side of the chamber, as if the person speaking were on the other side of the room. My recollection was that a member of that chamber used to pretend to put his head down at his desk for a nap and eavesdrop on his colleagues on the other side of the chamber.
Tricky, tricky. Finally, some of you had thoughts about our segment on the startup that ships Vermont's autumn leaves to customers for $20 per dozen. Jim remarked, "I should have thought of this years ago. If only I'd known people would pay good money for leaves, I would have been rich at $5 a leaf. Then again, people paid good money for rocks and cans of air, so why not?"
Jessie was not so cynical. She posted, "I have always decorated with leaves and continue to do so. I still have baskets full from last fall, and years ago I mentioned to folks that instead of purchasing those plastic ones, why not sell the beauty of what we have here to folks around the world? Just a touch of autumn love."
Well, if you have a comment, question, or a business plan to send to us, feel free to post it in Facebook on our webpage or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Thanks, Sam, and happy birthday.
Thanks very much, Jane.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, the fifth of five interviews with candidates for governor. Both the Republican and Democratic parties will have primaries for the open governor's seat in next year's election. Tomorrow, our guest is former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter. We'll talk about her run in the three-way race for the Democratic nomination for governor. And you can send your questions and comments for Sue Minter to vermontedition@vpr.net and then listen live tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.